Chapter 7. Chicago is a business town. Entrepreneurs of every stripe duke it out ferociously in pursuit of the American dream, discarding the carcasses of fallen ventures along the way. The town is full of old business headquarters, most of them held by the long-term commercial giants. When a new business sets its sights on Second City, it's cheaper for them to settle in one of the newer industrial parks littered around the city's suburbs. They all look more or less alike, a grid of plain, blocky, readily adaptable buildings, two or three stories high with no windows, no landscaping, and gravel parking lots. They look like enormous, ugly concrete bricks, but they're cheap. Arturo had acquired a short-term lease on such a building in such an industrial complex 20 minutes west of town. There were three other cars parked in its lot by the time I got there. I had a nylon backpack full of various magical tools I might need to ward off malevolent energies, salt, a bunch of white candles, holy water, a ring of keys, a small silver bell, and chocolate. Yeah, chocolate. Chocolate fends off all kinds of nasty stuff. And if you get hungry while warding off evil, you have a snack. It's multi-purpose equipment. One end of my carved wooden blasting rod protruded from the backpack in case I needed to make a fast draw. I was also wearing my shield bracelet, my mother's pentacle amulet, my force ring, and a new gizmo I'd been working with, a silver belt buckle carved into the shape of a standing bear. Better to have the magical arsenal and not need it than to not have it and get killed to death. I got out of the car. I had on a pair of slacks and a polo shirt, since I had no idea of what a production assistant on an adult film set was supposed to wear. The client would have to be happy with business casual. I slung the backpack over one shoulder and locked up the car. A second car pulled up as I did, a shiny green rental number, and parked next to the Blue Beetle. Two men got out. The driver was a fit-looking man, maybe in his late 30s. He was a little taller than average and had the build of someone who works out in a non-fanatic kind of way. His medium brown hair was long enough to look a little disheveled. He wore round-rimmed spectacles, a Nike t-shirt, and Levi's, and his cross-trainers probably cost him upwards of $100. He nodded at me and said, "Good morning," in a tone of genuine cheer. "Hi," I responded. "New guy?" he asked. "New guy. Cameraman? Stunt double. Cool." He grinned, pulled a designer-labeled gym bag out of the back of the rental car, and slung it over his shoulder. He approached, offering his hand. "I'm Jake." I traded grips with him. His hands had the calluses of someone who worked with them, and he had a confidence that conveyed strength without attempting to crush my fingers. I liked him. "Harry," I responded. The second man who got out of the rental car looked like a weightlifting commercial. He was tall and built like a statue of Hercules beneath tight leather pants and a sleeveless workout shirt. He had a high-tech tan, coal-black hair, and wasn't old enough to qualify for decent rates on his auto insurance. His face didn't match the Olympian body. His features rated on the western slope of the bell curve of physical appeal. Though, to be fair, he was staring at me with a murderous scowl, which probably biased my opinion. "Who the hell are you?" he growled. "I the hell am Harry," I said. He pulled out his own gym bag and slammed the car door closed. "You always a wise ass?" "No, sometimes I'm asleep." He took a pair of hard steps toward me and thrust the heel of one hand at my shoulder in a belligerent push. Classic macho jitsu. I could have done a bunch of fairly violent things in response, but I try not to get into fights in a gravel parking lot if I can help it. I took the push without yielding and grunted. "Your wrist is a little limp," I said. "If you like, I can show you an exercise or something, help you out." His face twisted with abrupt heat. "Son of a bitch," the man swore and dropped his bag so he could ball his huge hands into huge fists. "Whoa," Jake said and stepped between us, facing the big guy. "Hey, come on, Bobby. It's too early for this crap." Bobby got a lot more aggressive once Jake was there to hold him back, snarling and cussing. I'd face too many literal ogres to be too terribly impressed by a metaphorical one, but I was just as glad that it hadn't gone any farther. The kid was a hell of a lot stronger than me, and if he knew more than nothing about how to handle himself, he could ruin my whole day. The kid subsided after a minute, picked up his stuff again, and scowled at me. "I know what you're thinking, and you can forget it." I lifted my eyebrows. "So you're a psychic, too?" "Wise-ass stunt double," he snarled. "It happened once. You aren't going to make a name for yourself. You might as well just leave now." Jake sighed. "Bobby, he's not a stunt double." "But he said he was joking," Jake said. "Christ, he's newer at this than you. Look, just go inside. Get some coffee or spring water or something. You don't need this on a shooting day." The kid glared at me and jabbed his index finger at me. "I'm warning you, asshole. Stay out of my way if you don't want to get hurt." I tried to keep all the panic and terror he'd inspired off my face. "Okie doke." The kid snarled, spat on the ground in my direction, and then stormed inside. "Someone woke up with his testosterone in a knot today," I said. Jake watched Bobby go and nodded. "He's under pressure. Try not to take it personal, man." "That's tough," I said. "What with the insults and violent posturing and such?" Jake grimaced. "Nothing to do with you personally, man. He's worried." "About being replaced by a stunt double?" "Yeah." "Are you serious? What the hell did a stunt double do in a porno flick?" Jake waved a hand vaguely toward his belt. "Extreme close-ups." "What?" "Historically speaking, it doesn't happen often, especially what with Viagra now, but it isn't unknown for a director to bring in a double for the close of a scene if the actor is having trouble finishing." I blinked. "He thought I was a stunt penis?" Jake laughed at my reaction. "Man, you are new. You've been doing this work long?" "A while," he said. "Guess it's a dream job, huh? Gorgeous women and all?" He shrugged. "Not as much as you'd think. After a while, anyway." "Then why do you do it?" "Habit?" he asked with an easy grin. "Plus lack of options. I thought about doing the family thing once, but it didn't work out." He fell silent for a second, his expression touched with faint grief. He shook his head to come out of it and said, "Look, don't worry about Bobby. He'll calm down once he figures out his stage name." "Stage name?" "Yeah, I think that's what's got him all nervous. This is only his second shoot. First one is in the can, but it'll be a bit before they do final edits and such. He's got until next week to figure out his performing name." "Performing name, huh?" "Don't make fun of it," he said, expression serious. "Names have power, man."
"Do they? Really?"
Jake nodded. "A good name inspires confidence. It's important for a young guy."
"Like Dumbo's magic feather," I said.
"Right, exactly."
"So what name do you go by?" I asked.
"Jack Rockhart," Jake replied promptly. He eyed me for a moment, his expression assessing.
"What?" I asked.
"You mean you don't recognize the name? Or me?"
I shrugged. "I don't have a TV. Don't go to those theaters either."
His eyebrows shot up. "Really? Are you Amish or something?"
"Yeah, that's it. I'm Amish."
He grinned. "Maybe you better come inside with me. I'll introduce you around."
"Thanks."
"No problem," Jake said. We went on into the building, a place with sterile beige walls and invincible medium brown carpeting. Jake led me to a door with a computer-printed sign that read, "Green Room," and went inside. A long conference table ran down the center of a comfortably sized room. Donuts, drinks, fruits, bagels, and other foods of every description were laid out on trays down its length. The room smelled like fresh coffee, and I promptly homed in on the coffee machine for a cup. A plain-faced woman in her mid-40s entered, wearing jeans, a black tee, and a red and white flannel shirt. Her hair was tied back under a red bandana. She seized a paper plate and dumped food on it at random. "Good morning, Guffy."
"Joan,"
Jake responded easily. "Have you met Harry?"
"Not yet."
She glanced over her shoulder at me and nodded.
"Wow,
You are very tall.
I'm actually a midget. A haircut makes me look taller. Joan laughed and popped a donut hole in her mouth.
You're the production assistant, huh?
Yes.
She nodded.
So, let's produce.
I thought that was Arturo's bag.
He's the director and executive producer. I'm the actual producer. Makeup, cameras, lighting, sets, you name it. I handle the crew and the details.
She turned to me and offered her hand, shaking off sugary donut goodness as she did.
Joan Dallas.
Pleasure, I said. Harry Dresden.
Joan nodded.
Come on, then. There's still a lot to do before we can shoot. Guffy, get to the dressing room and clean yourself up.
Jake nodded.
Are they here yet?
Her tone of voice became annoyed.
Giselle and Emma are.
There was a moment of silent, pregnant tension. Jake winced and headed for the door.
Harry, nice to meet you. Joan's okay, but she'll work you to death.
Joan threw an apple at him. Jake caught it when it bounced off his chest, crunched into it with his teeth, and held it in his mouth so that he could wave as he left the room.
Grab yourself some food, Stilts, Joan said. You can help me put cameras together.
I was hoping to talk to Arturo before we got going, I said. She turned around with two plates loaded with breakfast pastries. She hadn't bothered getting any fruit.
You're a funny guy. He's probably not out of bed yet. Bring that box of cookies. If my blood sugar drops too low, I might take your head off.
She led me down a short hallway to a cavernous room, a shooting studio. A slightly raised stage held an unlit set, which looked like a lavishly appointed bedroom. Arrayed in a line in front of it were several black plastic crates and a freestanding shop light. Joan flicked it on and started opening crates, popping a bit of food into her mouth every third or fourth movement.
Nice place, I said.
Been a bitch, Joan said between bites. Last company here was supposed to be some kind of computer production deal, but they had to be lying. They redid all the wiring in here, routed in way heavier than they were supposed to have. Took me a week to get things working, and then I had to turn their old gym into something like a dressing room. But this place still isn't up to code.
You cannot change the laws of physics, I said.
She laughed.
Amen.
Engineer, then? I asked.
By way of necessity, she answered. I've done sets, lighting, power, even some plumbing.
And, she said, opening boxes, cameras.
Gather round, gopher boy. You can help.
I settled down while she laid out parts from heavy plastic crates. She assembled them, several professional cameras and tripods, with the surety of long practice. She gave me instructions as she did, and I did my best to help her out. There was a pleasant, quiet rhythm to the work, something that I hadn't really felt since the last time I'd been on a farm in Hog Hollow, Missouri. And it was interesting. Technology was unfamiliar territory for me. See, those who wield the primordial forces of creation have a long-running grudge with physics. Electronic equipment, in particular, tends to behave unpredictably, right up until it shuts down and stops working altogether. Old technologies seemed more stable, which was one reason I drove around town in a Volkswagen Beetle that had been built before the end of the Vietnam War. But newer products, video cameras, televisions, cell phones, computers, would die a horrible, fizzling death after any extended time in my presence. There was a sense of order to what we were doing that appealed to me on some level, putting parts together, locking them into place, lining up plugs into the corresponding sockets, taping groups of wires together so that they wouldn't get tangled. I did well enough that Joan sat back and watched me work on the last camera on my own.
So, how's it supposed to work? I said. What happens next?
The lights, she sighed. The damn lights are the most annoying part. We have to set them up so that no one looks too shiny or too wrinkly. Once that's done, I'll let the technical manager handle sound and go ride herd on the actors.
Metaphorically, I hope.
She snorted.
Yes, some of them are decent enough, like that blockhead Guffy. But if you don't push them into getting things done, they'll never be ready for the set on time. Makeup, costume, that sort of thing.
Ah, and some of them are late? I asked.
Scrump will be, she said. It almost came out a growl.
I pushed.
Who?
Trisha Scrump, actress. You don't like her? I asked. I despise that self-absorbed, egotistical little bitch, Joan said cheerfully. She'll play the princess, and everyone else in the cast will know that they don't have to show up on time, or be ready to go on time, or be entirely sober, since her lascivious Highness Trixie Vixen will be showing up late to everything anyway, high as a kite, and doing exactly as she pleases. I long to slap her silly. You shouldn't repress your emotions like that, I said. She let out a belly laugh. Sorry. No reason to drag a newbie into old politics. Guess I'm just upset to be working with her again. I didn't expect it. Aha. Hostility for the porn starlet. That's what we in the business call motive. Joan did not strike a creepy, murderous Strega vibe with me, but I'd learned the hard way that a skilled liar can look innocent right up until she stabs you in the back. I dug for more information, like a good investigator. Why not? She shook her head. When Arturo left Silverlight Studios to start his own company, he made a lot of people angry. What do you think about that? The move, I mean. She sighed. Arturo is an idiot. He's a kind man, and he means well, but he's an idiot. Anyone who works with him now risks getting blacklisted by Silverlight. Even Trixie? I mean, if she's a big star, won't the studio kind of kowtow to her? Joan leaned down to check a connection I'd made, shoving the plug in. Are you on drugs or something? She's a big star with a limited shelf life. They'd replace her without blinking. She sounds gutsy. Joan shook her head. Don't confuse courage with stupidity. I think she's vapid enough to actually believe she's too important to lose. If I didn't know better, I'd say you don't like her much. Doesn't matter whether or not I like her, Joan said. It's my job to work with her. I watched her set her mouth in a firm line as she started closing cases and stacking them up. I was willing to bet that Tricia Scrump, a.k.a. Trixie Vixen, didn't have the same kind of professional resolve. I helped Joan pick up the crates and tools and stack them against the far wall of the dim studio. She moved briskly, tension and distaste simmering under the surface of her determined expression. I studied her as covertly as I could. She clearly wasn't happy to be here. Could she be gunning for Arturo with some kind of heavy-duty entropy curse? It didn't track. There hadn't been any hostility when she spoke about Arturo, and if she were a strong enough practitioner to throw out deadly spells, she wouldn't be able to keep up a career amidst so much technology. If she was harboring vengeful feelings toward Arturo, she was the best actress I'd ever seen. I suppose that could have been possible, but my instincts were sending me mixed messages. On the one hand, they told me that Joan was on the level. On the other, they also told me there was more to the woman than met the eye. Something told me that things were more serious than they appeared, that this situation was even more dangerous than I had originally believed. It bothered me. It bothered me a lot. Joan shut the last case and interrupted my train of thought. Okay, then, she said. Let's get the studio powered up. I said, maybe I shouldn't be here when you do. She lifted her eyebrows, evidently waiting for an explanation. I said, I have a plate in my head. It's a little twitchy around electric fields, high voltage equipment, that kind of thing. I'd rather come in when it's already up and running so I can back off if there's a problem. Joan stared at me with a lot of skepticism. Is that so? Yeah, she frowned. How did you get this job? Christ, I'm a terrible liar. I tried to think of an answer that didn't begin with, But I was interrupted. A surge of silent, invisible energy swept through the room, cold and foul. My stomach twisted with abrupt nausea, and my skin erupted in goose flesh. Dark, dangerous magic swirled by, drawing my attention to the studio's exit. It was the kind of magic that destroys, warps, rots, and corrupts. The kind of magic you need to feed a deadly entropy curse. What's wrong? Joan shook me with one hand. Harry, you're shaking. Are you all right? I managed to choke out. Who else is in the building? Jake, Bobby, Emma, and Giselle. No one else. I stumbled to my pack and picked it up. If Joan hadn't helped me balance, I might have fallen down. Show me where.
Joan blinked in confusion.
What?
I shoved the sensation of the dark magic away as best I could and snarled.
They're in danger. Show me where. Now.
My tone might have alarmed her, but her expression became more worried than frightened. Joan nodded and half ran out of the studio, leading me out a side door, up a flight of metal spiral stairs, and into another hallway. We sprinted down it to a room with a sign on it that said, Dressing Room.
Get back, I said, and stepped in front of her.
I hadn't yet touched the doorknob when a woman began to scream.
Chapter 8.
I tore the door open onto a room the size of my apartment, lined with freestanding mirrors, folding tables, and chairs. A cloud of foul energy slapped me in the face. Bobby stood off to my right, his expression registering surprise and confusion. To my left stood a woman in the corner of my vision, mostly naked. I didn't stop to ogle, but ran through the room to a second door. It was partly open and swinging closed again. I slammed through it into a bathroom as big as my bedroom, which I suppose isn't all that unusual. The air was hot, humid, and smelled like fresh soap. The shower was running, its glass door broken into jagged teeth. The floor was covered in more broken glass, a little water, and a lot of blood. Two rigid, motionless bodies lay on the floor. My instincts screamed a warning, and just before I stepped into the pool of blood-stained water, I threw myself into a jump. My shins hit heavily on the counter of the sink, and I started to fall. I grabbed onto the faucet and hauled myself up. My shins hurt like hell, but I'd kept my feet off the floor. My brain caught up to my instincts, and I saw what was going on. The two people on the floor weren't motionless. They were locked into positions of rigid agony. Sparks leapt up in the back corner of the room. A heavy, high-voltage light fixture had broken loose from the ceiling and fallen, hauling exposed wiring to lie in the thin sheet of scarlet liquid on the floor. Like I said, I don't get along with technology when I'm trying to use it. But when I actually want to bust it up, I'm hell on wheels. I extended my right hand at the light fixture, snarled incoherently, and willed raw power over the electric menace like an invisible wrecking ball. The hex rippled through the air, and the live wires exploded into wild blue arcs of electricity for maybe 2 seconds. And then the lights went out. In the whole damn building. Whoops. I heard a pair of gasps from whoever was on the floor, presumably Jake and someone named Giselle. I got out my pentacle amulet.
What's happening?
Bobby's voice sounded suspicious.
Stars, what a dolt.
Hey, prick, what do you think you're doing?
Where are the damned emergency lights?
Said an annoyed female voice. A light flicked on in the dressing room, and Joan appeared at the bathroom door holding a pocket flashlight on her keychain.
What's going on?
Call 911, I snapped. Hurry, there's bleeding.
You need a light, Joan said.
Got one. I willed energy through the silver pentacle. It flickered and began to brighten with a steady blue glow that made the blood on the floor look black.
Hurry, and bring all the ice you can find with you when you come back.
Joan vanished from the door. She snarled,
Get out of the way, you blockhead!
And her footsteps retreated back down the hall. I got off the sink, splashed into the water, and knelt beside the downed people. Jake, naked from the waist up, stirred as I did.
Ow,
he said in a rough voice.
Ow.
Are you all right? I asked. He sat up, wobbling a little.
Never mind. Giselle, she must have slipped in the shower. I came in to help her.
I turned my attention to the girl. She was young and a little scrawny for my tastes, all long limbs and long hair. I rolled her onto her back. She had a cut running the length of her neck, curving from the base of her ear to above her collarbone. Blood shone on her skin, her mouth was partly open, and her dark eyes were glassy.
Crap,
I said. I seized a towel from a large shelf of them and pressed it down hard on the girl's wound.
Jake, I need you.
He looked up a little blearily.
Is she dead?
She will be if you don't help. Hold this down hard. Keep pressure on the wound.
Okay.
He didn't look steady, but he clenched his jaw and did as I instructed. While I elevated her feet with a rolled towel, Jake said,
I can't feel a pulse. She isn't breathing.
Damn it. I tilted the girl's head back and made sure her mouth was clear. I sealed my mouth to hers and blew in hard. Then I drew back and put the heels of my hands near her sternum. I wasn't sure how hard to push. The practice dummy in the CPR class didn't have ribs to break. I guessed and hoped I got it right. 5 pushes, then another breath. 5 more, then another breath. The blue light from my amulet bobbed and waved about, making shadows lurch and shift. For the record, CPR is hard to do for very long. I made it for maybe 6 or 7 minutes and was getting too dizzy to see when Jake told me to switch off with him. We swapped jobs. Joan returned with a big steel bowl of shaved ice, and I had her fold it into another towel, which I then pressed down over the wound.
What are you doing? Joan asked.
She's cut bad. If we get her heart started, she'll bleed out, I panted. The cold will make the blood vessels constrict, slow down the bleeding. It might buy her some time.
Oh, God, Joan muttered. Poor thing.
I leaned down to peer at her face. The skin on the left side of her features and on her throat was covered in blotches of dark, angry red.
Look, burns.
From the electricity? Joan asked. Her face wasn't in the water, I said. I squinted between the girl and the shower.
The water, I said.
It turned hot on her. She got scalded and fell right through the damn glass. Joan flinched, as if she'd been stabbed with a knife, and her face turned gray.
Oh, my God. This is my fault. I hooked up the water heater myself.
Jinxed, said Bobby from the dressing room. This whole shoot is jinxed. We're screwed. Joan was holding herself steady, but tears fell from off her chin onto the naked girl. I kept pressure on the injury.
I don't think this was your fault. I want you to get out front and show the paramedics in when they arrive.
Her face still ashen, she rose and took off without looking back. Jake kept up the mouth-to-mouth like he knew what he was doing. I was panting and holding the towel and ice against the wound when the paramedics finally showed up, carrying heavy-duty flashlights and rolling a wheeled stretcher between them. I told them what had happened to the girl and got out of their way, taking a seat on the corner of a counter that ran along a wall of makeup mirrors. Jake joined me a minute later.
Thought I felt her breathe, he panted, his tone subdued.
We watched the paramedics work.
God, this is really terrible. What are the odds of all that happening, you know?
I frowned and closed my eyes, extending my senses into the room around me. Somewhere in the furor and panic, the choking cloud of destructive magic had dissipated. Barely a trace remained. With the crisis over and no action to occupy my mind, my hands started shaking, and I saw a few stars in the corner of my vision. A phantom surge of panic sent my heart and breathing racing. I bowed my head and rubbed at the back of my neck, waiting for it to pass. The paramedics had some big old flashlights, so I put my amulet away, letting the blue light die out.
You all right? Jake asked. We'll be in a minute. I hope she'll be okay.
Jake nodded, frowning.
Maybe Bobby's right.
About a jinx?
Maybe.
He studied me for a second, expression guarded.
How did you know?
Know what?
That we were in trouble. I mean, I thought you were in the studio. I ran in a couple of seconds after I heard her fall, and I was only a few feet away. You must have come through the door a couple of seconds after I did. How did you know?
Just lucky. We finished the cameras, and Joan took me up there to introduce me or something.
What was that light you had?
I shrugged. Present from a friend's kid. Some kind of fancy new thing the kids have. Light up jewelry for dance clubs and keggers. They call them raves now.
Raves, right.
Jake watched me for a moment and then slowly nodded his head.
Sorry, I'm being paranoid, I think.
Been there, no problem. He nodded and slumped down tiredly.
I thought I was a dead man in there. Thank you.
It seemed smart to keep the wizard thing as low-key as possible. Someone was flinging some nasty energy around. No sense in advertising my identity as a wizard of the White Council.
I didn't do much but run in, I said. We're just lucky the power went out.
Yeah. The paramedics stood up, loaded Giselle onto the stretcher, and picked it up. Jake and I both came to our feet as they did.
Is she going to be okay? He asked.
The paramedics didn't slow down, but one of them said, She's got a chance. The man nodded to me. Without the ice, she wouldn't have had that. Jake frowned and chewed on his lip, clearly upset.
Take care of her.
The paramedics started moving out with quick, steady steps.
Sir, you better come along with us to the hospital so that the doctors can check you out.
I feel fine, Jake said.
The paramedics went around the corner, but the second one called back.
Electricity can do some nasty damage you might not feel. Come on.
But Jake stayed where he was. The paramedics took their lights with them, leaving the dressing room in darkness for a moment until Joan returned with her little flashlight.
Guffy, get your bow-flexed ass into that ambulance.
He looked up at his reflection in the mirrored wall. His hair was sticking up every which way.
Though I apparently see the same stylist as Einstein, the Bride of Frankenstein, and Don King, I feel fine. Don't worry about me.
I thought you'd say that, she said. Fine. I'll drive you there myself. Everyone else needs to leave until I can make sure the power lines aren't going to kill anyone. Bobby and Emma are already outside. Harry, be back here by 3, all right?
Why?
I asked.
To start shooting.
Shooting? Jake blurted. After that?
She grimaced.
The show must go on. Everyone out so I can lock up. Guffy, get in my car and don't argue with me. Arturo is meeting us at the hospital.
Okay, Jake said. He didn't sound like he minded agreeing.
What about Bobby and Emma? They have a car?
Don't think so.
Jake picked up his sports bag, dug in it, and tossed me a set of keys.
Here, give those to Emma for me.
I caught them, and we all started out of the building.
Gotcha.
Joan sighed.
Maybe we are jinxed. It's like someone said Macbeth.
What are the odds? Jake agreed.
Bubble, bubble, toil and trouble. Fire, burn, and cauldron, bubble. I didn't say anything to them, but I was pretty sure things would get worse before they got better. A whole lot worse.
Chapter 9.
We went outside. Joan and Jake spoke briefly with Bobby and the woman I presumed to be Emma. Then Joan chivied Jake into a car and drove out in a hurry, leaving the stage open for me to do some more snooping. There wasn't any time to waste with lethal magic like that on the loose, and the keys gave me a good excuse to do some more sniffing around. I didn't hold out much hope that anything in Bobby the Bully's head would be important, so I focused on the woman and walked over to them.
Hey, I'm Harry, production assistant.
Emma, the woman said. She was actually very pretty. She had the kind of beauty that seemed to convey a sense of personal warmth, of kindness, a face best suited to smiling. Her eyes were shamrock green, her skin pale, her hair long and red, highlighted with streaks of sunny gold. She wore jeans with a black sweater and made both of them look inviting. But she wasn't smiling. She offered me her hand.
I'm pleased to meet you. I'm glad you were there to help them.
Anyone would have, I said.
Come on, Emma, Bobby said, his expression sullen. Let's call a cab and go.
She ignored him.
I don't think I've seen you around before.
No, I'm local. A friend introduced me to Arturo, told him I needed a job.
Emma pursed her lips and nodded.
He's a softy, she said. In case no one's told you, this isn't an average day on the set.
I'd hope not.
I'm sorry about your friend.
Emma nodded. Poor Giselle. I hope she'll be all right. She's from France. Doesn't have any family. I couldn't see her from where I was standing. Was it her throat that was hurt?
Yeah.
Where? I mean, where was she hurt?
I drew a line on my own face, starting at the back corner of my jaw and curving around to beside my Adam's apple.
There. Back to front.
Emma shuddered visibly. God, the scars. If she lives, I doubt she'll mind them.
Like hell she won't, Emma said. They'll show. No one will cast her.
Could have been worse. She eyed me.
You don't approve of her profession?
I didn't say that.
What, are you a religious type or something?
No, I just... Because if you are, I'd like to tell you right now that I'm not. And I don't appreciate it when people pass judgment on my line of work. I'm not religious. I get so tired of hypocritical bastards who...
She started to say something else, then made a visible effort and shut her mouth.
I'm sorry. I'm not usually oversensitive. Sometimes I just get sick of people telling me how bad my work is for me, how it corrupts my soul, that I should abandon it and give my life to God.
You're not going to believe me, I said, but I know exactly what you mean.
You're right, she said. I don't believe you. Her belt chirped, and she drew a cell phone from its clip.
Yes, she paused for a moment.
No.
No, sweetheart. Mommy already told you before I left, if Gracie says you get one cookie, then you only get one cookie. She's the boss until Mommy comes home.
She listened for a moment and then sighed.
I know, sweetie. I'm sorry. I'll be home soon, okay? I love you too, sweetie. Kisses. Bye-bye.
Kid, I asked. She gave me half of a smile as she put the phone back onto her belt.
Two. Their grandmother is with them.
I frowned.
Wow. I never really thought about, actresses with children.
Not many do, she said.
Does their father mind your career?
Her eyes flashed hotly. He isn't involved with them. Or me.
Oh, I said. I offered her the keys. From Jake, for the car. Sorry if I offended you. I didn't mean to.
She exhaled, and it seemed to let out the pressure of her anger. She accepted them.
Not your fault. I'm tense.
Everyone around here seems to be, I said.
Yeah, it's this film. If it doesn't do well, we're all going to be looking for work.
Why?
She shrugged a shoulder. It's complicated, but we're all on contract with Silverlight. Arturo left them, but he had managed to slip something into his own contract with the studio that would let him continue hiring cast from Silverlight for 3 months after his departure.
Oh, I said. Jake said something about another movie. She nodded.
Arturo wanted to do three of them. This is the second. If the movies go over well, Arturo will have a name for himself, and we'll all have leverage to either quit the contract with Silverlight or renegotiate better terms.
I see, I said. And if the movies crash, Silverlight will never pick up your contracts.
Exactly, she frowned. And we've had so many problems. Now this.
Come on, Emma! Bobby called. I'm starving. Let's go find something.
You should start practicing some self-restraint for a change. The woman's green eyes flashed with irritated anger, but she smoothed it away from her face and said,
I'll see you here this afternoon then, Harry. Nice to meet you.
Likewise. She turned and glowered at Bobby as she walked to the car. They got in without speaking, Emma driving, and left the lot. I walked over to my car, pensive. Thomas and Arturo had been right. Someone had whipped out one hell of a nasty entropy curse. Assuming that this wasn't a coincidental focus of destructive energy, the mystical equivalent of being struck with a bolt of lightning. Sometimes energy can build up due to any number of causes. Massive amounts of emotion, traumatic events, even simple geography. That energy influences the world around us. It's what gives the Cubbies the home field advantage, though that whole billy goat thing sort of cancels it out, leaves an intangible aura of dread around sites of tragic and violent events, and causes places to get a bad reputation for strange occurrences. I hadn't sensed any particular confluence of energies until just before the curse happened to Giselle and Jake, but that didn't entirely rule out coincidence. There is a whole spectrum of magical energies that are difficult to define or understand. There are thousands of names for them in every culture. Mana, psychic energy, totem, juju, chi, bioetherial power, the force, the soul. It's an incredibly complex system of interweaving energy that influences good old Mother Earth around us. But it all boils down to a fairly simple concept. Shit happens. But then again, other people around Arturo had been hurt. I could buy that lightning could strike once, but if I hadn't interfered, it would have hit 4 times. Not much chance for coincidence there. No matter how much I might have wished it, the energy that had caused Giselle to slip into the glass door, the glass to break and cut her, and the lights to fall down and electrify the floor was not one of those natural hot spots of power. It had swirled past me like some vast and purposeful serpent, and it hadn't gone after the first person to cross its path. It had ignored me, Joan, Jake, Bobby, and Emma, and gone into the shower after the girl. So Arturo was wrong about at least one thing. He wasn't the target of the Molochio. The women around him were. And that pissed me off. Call me a Neanderthal if you like, but I get real irrational about bad things happening to women. Human violence was at its most hideous when a woman was on the receiving end, and supernatural predators were even worse. That was why seeing Thomas in Trans Justine had set me off. I knew the girl was willing, sure. I was pretty sure Thomas didn't want any harm to come to her, but the more primitive instincts in me only saw that she was a woman and Thomas had been preying upon her. No matter what the rational part of my head thinks, when I see someone hurt a woman, my inner Gigantopithecus wants to reach for the nearest bone and go Kubrickian on someone's head. I got into the car, frowning more deeply, and forced myself to calm down and think. I took deep breaths until I relaxed enough to start analyzing what I knew. The attacks had the feeling of vendetta to it. Someone had a grudge against Arturo and was deliberately striking women near him. Who would hold a grudge that vicious? A jealous woman, maybe, especially since he was a man with 3 ex-wives. Madge was in business with Arturo, though. She didn't seem to me the sort who would jeopardize her fortunes with something so primitive and intangible as vengeful hatred. The most recent wife, Tricia, was in the same situation, though I hadn't yet met her. The other ex-wife, Lucille, maybe, was not supposed to be in the picture. Could she be using magic to get a little payback? I shook my head and started my car. I'd been briefly exposed to an entropy curse once. It had been a lot more powerful than the Molochio that had nearly killed Jake and Giselle. I barely survived it, even with a hefty arsenal of magic and the sacrifice of a good man's life to divert the curse from me. I'd saved Jake and Giselle, but I'd been lucky. It could as easily have been me getting electrocuted in a pool of my own blood. I'd managed to mitigate the Molochio, barely, but there was nothing to say that it couldn't happen again. And it was more than possible that next time the lance of vicious magic would be aimed right at me. I started up the Blue Beetle and headed for my office, pondering on the road. I didn't have enough information to make a solid guess on a perpetrator. Maybe it would make more sense to examine the murder weapon, as it were, and determine how it was being used. Curses had the same sort of limitation as any other spell, after all, which meant that whoever was sending the evil eye had to have some sort of means of directing the magic at a target. Body parts worked best. A lock of hair, nail clippings, and fresh blood were the most common items used, but they weren't the only ones. A poppet, a little dolly dressed up like the intended victim, could also be used to aim a malevolent spell. I've heard you can even employ a good photo. But targeting the spell was only one part of the process. Before the killer could send it anywhere, he had to gather up the energy to make it happen. A curse that strong would require a whole lot of work, gathering and focusing raw magic in one place. And after that, the energy would have to be molded, shaped into its desired result. Even among the magically gifted, that kind of discipline was rare. Sure, any of the White Council could do that as a matter of routine, but the White Council didn't include everyone with magical skill. Most weren't talented enough to apply for an apprenticeship, and there were plenty of people who washed out and never made it through their schooling. Magic this powerful would be a dangerous business for someone new to the use of magic. Odds were good that this wasn't some petty, jealous whim of an arcane dabbler. Someone with a disturbing amount of ability was methodically committing murder. But why? Why kill women working for Arturo? What effect would it have? The people involved in his films were clearly very nervous. Maybe someone was attempting to spread terror to cause Arturo's business venture to implode. Vengeance of some kind could be a motive, but after a moment's thought, I decided that greed opened up the field to more possibilities. Greed is a nice, sterile motivation. If the money's right, you don't need to know someone to take advantage of them. You don't have to hate them or love them or be related to them. You don't even have to know who they are. You just have to want money more than you want them to keep on breathing. And if history is any indicator, that isn't a terribly uncommon frame of mind. I parked in my building's lot and stomped up the stairway to my office. Who would gain by Arturo's ruin? Silverlight Studios. I nodded. That line of thought fit a lot better than some sort of demented vengeance kick. It was a good place to get started, and I had a couple of hours to put to use. With luck, I could dig up the information I would need to support, or demolish, the idea of a bad guy with dollar signs where his conscience should be. I opened my office door, but before I could go inside, I felt something cold and hard press against the back of my neck, the barrel of a gun. My heart fluttered into sudden, startled panic. "Go into the office," said a quiet, rough voice, relaxed and masculine. "Don't make this any louder than it has to be." Chapter 10. Apparently, a gun held to the back of my head engenders a sense of fellowship and goodwill in the depths of my soul. I cooperated. I unlocked the door to the office, and the gunman followed me in. My office isn't big, but it's on the corner and has windows on two walls. There's a table, a counter with my old coffee machine on it, some metal filing cabinets, and a table holding a display of pamphlets meant to help public relations with the normals. My desk sat in the corner between the windows, two comfy chairs for clients facing it. The gunman walked me to one of my comfy chairs and said, "Sit." I sat. "Hey, man, look." The gun pressed harder. "Hush." I hushed. A second later, something slapped my shoulder. "Take it," the gunman said. "Put it on." I reached back and found a heavy cloth sleeping mask with an elastic head strap. "Why?" The gunman must have thumbed back the hammer of his weapon because it clicked. I put the stupid mask on. "You might not know this, but I don't function all that well as an investigator when blinded." "That's the idea," the gunman drawled. The gun left my neck. "Try not to make me feel threatened," he said through a yawn. "I'm all spooked and jittery. If you make any noise or start to get up, I'll probably twitch, and this trigger is pretty sensitive. My gun is pointed at your nose. The ensuing cause and effect chain could be inconvenient for you." "Maybe next time you could just say freeze," I said. "No need to walk me through it step by step." His tone sounded like he'd colored it with a faint smile. "Just want to make sure you understand the situation. If I blew your head off over a stupid misunderstanding, gosh, would our faces be red." He paused, then added, "Well, mine, anyway." He didn't sound jumpy to me. He sounded bored. I heard him moving around for a minute, and then there was a sudden vibration in the air. I felt as if the skin of my face had suddenly dried into leather and tightened over my cheekbones. "Okay," he said. "That'll do. Take it off." I took the mask off and found the gunman sitting on the edge of my desk, a compact semi-automatic in his hand. He had it pointed at me in a casual way. He was a big guy, almost my own height, with dark golden hair, just long enough to look a little exotic. He had gray-blue eyes that stayed steady and missed nothing. He wore casual black pants and a black sports jacket over a gray T-shirt. He was built more like a swimmer than a weightlifter. all leonine power and lazy grace taken completely for granted. I looked around and saw a circle of salt as wide as two of my fingers poured around the chair. A Morton's salt cylinder sat on the floor nearby. A bit of scarlet stained some of the salt circle, blood. He'd used it to power up the circle, and I could feel its energy trapping all the magic in it, including my own. The circle had formed a barrier that would stop magical energy cold. I'd have to physically break the circle of salt and disrupt that barrier before I could send any magic at the gunman, which was probably the point. I eyed him and said, "Kincaid, I didn't expect to hear from you until tomorrow at least." "Rolling stones and moss, baby," the mercenary responded. "I was going through Atlanta when I got your message. Wasn't hard to get a direct flight here." "What's with the Gestapo treatment?" He shrugged. "You're a pretty unpredictable guy, Dresden. I don't mind making a social call, but I needed assurance that you were really you."
"I assure you that I'm me."
"That's nice."
"Now what?"
He rolled one shoulder in a shrug.
"Now we have a nice talk."
"While you point a gun at me?" I asked.
"I just want a friendly chat without either of us getting his brain redecorated with magic."
"I can't do that," I said. He shook a finger at me in a negative gesture.
"The council will burn anyone who gets caught doing it. That's different."
He nodded at the circle.
"But from in there, you literally can't. I'm here to talk business, not to die of stupidity. If you like, think of the precautions as a compliment."
I folded my arms.
"Because nothing says flattery like a gun to the head." "Ain't that God's own truth?" Kincaid said.
He set the gun down on my desk, put his left hand on it.
"Dresden, I'm just plain folks. I'm still alive because I don't take stupid chances or walk into things blindly."
I tried to ditch the stubborn anger and nodded.
"Okay, then. No harm, no foul."
"Good." He checked a nylon strap watch on his left wrist. "I haven't got all day. You wanted to talk to me, so talk." I felt annoyed enough to start screaming, but forced myself to rein it in.
"There's a scourge of vampires in town."
"Black Court?"
"Yeah," I said.
"Who's Scourge?"
"Mavra."
Kincaid pursed his lips.
"Cagey old hag. I hear she heads up a pretty big crew."
"Yeah, I'm gonna downsize them." Kincaid's index finger tapped on his gun.
"Black Court are tough to take down."
"Unless you get them in their coffins," I said. "I can find them."
"You want me to bodyguard you until then?"
"No, I want you to go there with me and help me kill them all."
A smile parted his lips from white teeth. "Going on an offensive would be nice. I'm getting bored on defense. What's the play?"
"Find them, kill them."
Kincaid nodded. "Simple enough."
"Yeah, that's the idea.
What are you going to cost me?"
He told me.
I choked.
"Do you offer coupons or anything?"
Kincaid rolled his eyes and stood up.
"Christ, why did you waste my time, Dresden?"
"Wait," I said. "Look, I'll figure out a way to pay you."
He arched an eyebrow.
"I'm good for it."
"Maybe," he said. "But it's funny how spending a lifetime as a hired gun makes you a little cynical."
"Take a chance," I said. "I'll get the money to you, and I'll owe you one."
His eyes glittered, flickers of malice and amusement sharing space in them.
"Owed a favor by the infamous Dresden. I guess it might be worth enough of my time to give you a chance."
"Great. Two conditions," he said.
"Like?" "I want at least one more set of eyes along," he said. "Someone good in a fight."
"Why?"
"Because if someone gets hurt, it takes two people to get him out alive. One to carry him, and one to lay down cover fire."
"I didn't think you cared."
"Of course I do," he said. "The wounded guy might be me."
"Fine," I said. "What's the second condition?"
"You need to understand that if you try to stiff me, I'll have to protect my interests."
He lifted a hand.
Don't get me wrong, it's just business. Nothing personal.
It won't be an issue, I said. Besides, you wouldn't want to eat my death curse, would you?
No. So I'd use a rifle at 1,000 yards. The bullet outruns its own sonic boom, and you'd never even hear the shot. You'd be dead before you realized what happened.
That scared me. I've faced more than a few gruesome or nightmarish creatures, but none of them had been that calm and practical. Kincaid believed that he could kill me, if it came to that. And thinking about it, I believed him, too. He watched my face for a minute, and his smile turned a shade wolfish.
You sure you want me on board?
There was a pregnant half-second of silence.
Yeah. All right.
Kincaid stepped forward and brushed the salt circle with his toe. The tension of the circle's barrier vanished.
But I'm on the clock. I've got to get back to Ivy's place before Sunday.
Understood, I said. How do I get in touch? He slipped his gun into his jacket pocket and drew out a gray business card. He put the card on my desk and said, "Pager." He turned to leave. I stood up and said, "Hey, Kincaid." He glanced back at me. I tossed the sleep mask to him. He caught it.
"Just plain folk?" I asked.
"Yeah." "Not supernatural?"
"I wish," he said. "Vanilla mortal."
"You're a liar." His features smoothed into a neutral mask.
"Excuse me?"
"I said you're a liar. I saw you during the fight at Wrigley, Kincaid. You fired 12 shots, on the move, and dodging bad guys the whole time."
"What's so supernatural about that?"
"In a fight, just plain folks miss sometimes, maybe most times. You didn't miss once."
"What's the point of shooting if you're just going to miss?"
He smiled, made a mime gun of his thumb and index finger, and aimed at me. His thumb fell forward, and he said,
"I'm as human as you are, Dresden. I'll see you later."
Then he left. I didn't know whether to feel better or worse. On one hand, he was an experienced gunman, and absolutely deadly in a fight. Human or not, I might need someone like that with me when I confronted Mavra. On the other hand, I had no idea how I would be able to pay him. And I believed him when he said he'd assassinate me. The entire concept was scary as hell. The threat of a death curse that could be levied against a wizard slayer was a major asset. It meant that anyone or anything that tried to attack a member of the White Council would hesitate, unwilling to risk the burst of destructive power a wizard could release in the last instance of his life. But those instants would be too slow against a high-powered sniper round fired from ambush. I could imagine it. A flash and a thump on the back of my head, a split second of surprise, and then blackness before I could even realize the need to pronounce my curse. Kincaid was right. It could work. The tactical doctrine of the powers that be in the magical communities of the world tended to run along a couple of centuries behind the rest of the planet. It was entirely possible that the senior-most wizards of the White Council had never even considered the possibility. Ditto for vampires. But it could work. The future abruptly seemed like a fairly unpleasant place for professional wizards. I set about cleaning up the salt and settled down at my little desk, putting my thoughts in order.
I had to find out more about the circumstances around the victims of the Malocchio.
I had to go digging for more information on Arturo Genosa's venture into the world of erotic film. And if that wasn't enough, while I did all of that, I also had to figure out how to get enough money to keep my own hired thug from putting holes in my skull. For most people, it would be a desperate situation. But most people hadn't been through them as many times as I had. My worry and tension slowly grew, and as they did, I took a perverse comfort in the familiar emotions. It actually felt good to feel my survival instincts put me on guard against premature mortality. Hell's bells. Is that insane or what?
Chapter 11. I ran up a long-distance bill while I did my digging on Genosa. I called a dozen different organizations and business entities around Los Angeles, but computers answered almost every phone, and everyone I talked to referred me to their homepage on the Internet. Evidently, conversation with an actual human being had become passé. Stupid Internet. I hit some walls, slammed my head against some closed doors, got a little information, and ran out of time. I wrote down Internet addresses, picked up some food, and went to see Murphy. Special Investigations has its office in one of the clump of mismatched buildings comprising Chicago Police Headquarters. I checked in with a desk sergeant and showed him the consultant's ID card Murphy had given me. The man made me sign in and waved me through. I marched up the stairs and came out on the level housing holding cells and special investigations. I opened the door to SI and stepped inside. The main room was maybe 50 feet long and 20 wide, and desks were packed into it like sardines. The only cubicle walls in the room were around a small waiting area with a couple of worn old couches and a table with some magazines for bored adults and some toys for bored children. One of them, a plush Snoopy doll spotted with old dark stains, lay on the floor. The puppy stood over it, tiny teeth sunk into one of the doll's ears. He shook his head, his own torn ear flapping, and dragged Snoopy in a little circle while letting out small, squeaky growls. The puppy looked up at me. His tail wagged furiously, and he savaged the doll with even more enthusiasm. "Hey," I told him, "Murphy's supposed to be watching you. What are you doing?" The puppy growled and shook Snoopy harder. "I can see that," I sighed. "Some babysitter she is." A tall man, going bald by degrees and dressed in a rumpled brown suit, looked up from his desk. "Hey there, Harry." "Sergeant Stallings," I responded. "Nice moves on Murphy today. The way you slammed her foot with your stomach was inspiring." He grinned. "I was expecting her to go for a lock. Woman is a nasty infighter. Everyone tried to tell O'Toole, but he's still young enough to think he's invincible." "I think she made her point," I said. "She around?" Stallings glanced down the long room at the closed door to Murphy's cheap, tiny office. "Yeah, but you know how she is with paperwork. She's ready to tear someone's head off." "Don't blame her," I said, and scooped up the puppy. "You get a dog?" "Nah, charity case. Murphy was supposed to be keeping an eye on him. Buzzer for me?" Stallings shook his head and turned his phone around to face me. "I plan to retire. You do it." I grinned and went on down to Murphy's office, nodding to a couple other guys with SI along the way. I knocked on the door. "God damn it!" Murphy swore from the other side. "I said not now!" "It's Harry," I said. "Just stopping by to get the dog."
"Oh, God!" she snarled. "Back away from the door!"
I did. A second later, the door opened and Murphy glared up at me, blue eyes bright and cold. "Get more away. I've been fighting this computer all day long. I swear if you blow out my hard drive again, I'm taking it out of your ass."
"Why would your hard drive be in my ass?" I said.
Murphy's eyes narrowed. "Yeah, okay. I'll be going then."
"Whatever," she said, and shut her office door hard.
I frowned. Murphy wasn't really a whatever sort of person. I tried to remember the last time I'd seen Murphy that short and abrupt. When she'd been in the midst of post-traumatic stress, she'd been remote, but not angry. When she was keyed up for a fight or feeling threatened, she'd be furious, but she didn't draw away from her friends. The only thing that had come close to this was when she thought I was involved in a string of supernatural killings. From where she'd been standing, it looked like I had betrayed her trust, and she had expressed her anger with a right cross that had chipped one of my teeth. Something was upsetting her. A lot.
"Merv," I asked through the door, "where did the aliens hide your pod?"
She opened the door enough to scowl at me.
"What's that supposed to mean?"
"No pod, huh? Maybe you're an evil twin from another dimension or something?" The muscles along her jaw clenched, and her expression promised murder. I sighed.
"You don't seem to be your usual self. I'm not an analyst or anything, but you kind of look like something is bothering you. Just maybe."
She waved a hand. It's this paperwork.
No, it isn't, I said. Come on, Murphy, it's me.
I don't want to talk about it.
I shrugged. Maybe you need to. You're about 2 steps shy of psychotic right now. She reached for her door again, but didn't close it.
Just a bad day.
I didn't believe her, but I said, sure, okay. I'm sorry if the dog added to it. Her expression became tired. She leaned against the doorway.
No, he was great. Barely made a sound. Quiet as a mouse all day long. Even used the papers I put down.
I nodded.
You sure you don't want to talk?
She grimaced and glanced around the office.
Maybe not here. Walk with me.
We left and headed down the hall to the vending machines. Murphy didn't say anything until she bought a Snickers bar.
My mom called, she said.
Bad news? I asked.
Yeah.
She closed her eyes and bit off a third of the candy bar.
Sort of. Not really.
Oh, I said, as if her answer made some kind of sense. What happened? She ate more chocolate and said,
my sister, Lisa, is engaged.
Oh, I said. When in doubt, be noncommittal.
I didn't know you had a sister. She's my baby sister.
My condolences, I guessed. She glowered at me.
She did this on purpose, with the reunion this weekend. She knew exactly what she was doing.
Well, it's a good thing someone knew, because so far I have no freaking clue.
Murphy finished the candy bar.
My baby sister is engaged. She's going to be showing up this weekend with her fiancé, and I'm going to be there without a fiancé, or a husband, or even a boyfriend. My mother will never let me hear the end of it.
Well, you had a husband, right? 2 of them, even. She glared.
The Murphys are Irish Catholic, she said. My not one, but 2, count them, 2 divorces won't exactly wash clean the stigma.
Oh. Well, I'm sure whoever you're dating would show up with you, right? She glanced back toward the SI offices. If looks could kill, hers would have blown that section of the building into Lake Michigan.
Are you kidding? I don't have time. I haven't been on a date in 2 years.
Maybe I should have gone for the ultimate inept remark and started singing about how short people got nobody to love. I decided to sting her pride a little instead. She'd reacted well to it before. The mighty Murphy, slayer of various and sundry nasty monsters, vampires, and so on.
And trolls, Murphy said. 2 more when you were out of town last summer.
Uh-huh. And you're letting a little family shindig get you down like this? She shook her head.
Look, it's a personal thing between me and my mom.
And your mom is going to think less of you for being single. A career woman? I regarded her skeptically. Murphy, don't tell me you're a mama's girl under all the tough chick persona. She stared at me for a moment, exasperation and sadness sharing space on her features.
I'm the oldest daughter, she said, and, well, the whole time I was growing up, I just assumed that I'd be her successor, I guess, that I'd follow her example. We both did. It's one of the things that made us close. The whole family knew it.
And if your baby sister is all of a sudden more like your mom than you are, what? It threatens your relationship with her?
No, she said, annoyance in her tone. Not like that. Not really. And sort of. It's complicated.
I can see that, I said. She slumped against the vending machine.
My mom is pretty cool, Murphy said, but it's been hard to stay close to her the past few years. I mean, the job keeps me busy. She doesn't think I should have divorced my second husband, and that's been between us a little. And I've changed. The past couple of years have been scary. I learned more than I wanted to know.
I winced. Yeah. Well, I tried to warn you about that.
You did, she said. I made my choice. I can handle living with it.
but I can't exactly sit down and chat with her about it. So it's one more thing that I can't talk about with my mother. Little things, you know? A lot of them, pushing us apart.
So talk to her, I said. Tell her there's stuff you can't talk about. Doesn't mean you don't want to be around her.
I can't do that, I blinked.
Why not?
Because I can't, she said. It just doesn't work like that.
Murphy had genuine worry on her face and actual tears in her eyes, and I started feeling out of my depth. Maybe because it was a family thing, it seemed like something completely alien, and I didn't get it.
Murphy was worried about being close to her mom.
Murphy should just go talk to her mom, right? Bite the bullet and clear the air. With anyone else, she'd have handled the problem exactly that way.
But I've noticed that people got the most irrational whenever family was around, while simultaneously losing their ability to distinguish reason from insanity. I call it familial dementia. I may not have understood the problem, but Murphy was my friend. She was obviously hurting, and that's all I really needed to know.
Look, Murph, maybe you're making more of it than you need to. I mean, seems to me that if your mom cares about you, she'd be as willing as you are to talk.
She doesn't approve of my career, Murphy said tiredly. Or my decision to live alone, once I was divorced. We've already done all the talking on those subjects, and neither one of us is going to budge.
Now that I could understand. I'd been on the receiving end of Murphy's stubborn streak before, and I had a chipped tooth to show for it.
So you haven't shown up at the reunion, where you'd see her and have to avoid all kinds of awkward topics for the past 2 years.
Something like that, Murphy said. People are talking, and we're all Murphys, so sooner or later someone is going to start giving unasked-for advice, and then it will be a mess.
But I don't know what to do. My sister getting engaged is going to get everyone talking about subjects I'd rather slash my wrist than discuss with my uncles and cousins.
So don't go, I said.
And hurt my mom's feelings a little more, she said.
Hell, probably make people talk even more than if I was there.
I shook my head.
Well, you're right about one thing. I don't understand it, Murph.
It's okay, she said.
But I wish I did, I said. I wish I worried about my uncle's opinions and had problems to work out with my mom. Hell, I'd settle for knowing what her voice sounded like. I put a hand on her shoulder.
Trite, but true. You don't know what you have until it's gone. People change. The world changes. And sooner or later, you lose people you care about. If you don't mind some advice from someone who doesn't know much about families, I can tell you this. Don't take yours for granted. It might feel like all of them will always be there. But they won't.
She looked down so that I couldn't see a tear fall, I guess.
Talk to her, Karen.
You're probably right, she said, nodding. So I'm not going to kill you for shoving your well-intentioned opinion down my throat in a vulnerable moment. Just this once.
That's decent of you, I said.
She took a deep breath, flicked a hand at her eyes, and looked up with a more businesslike face.
You're a good friend, putting up with this crap. I'll make it up to you sometime.
Funny you should say that, I said.
Why?
I'm scouting out a money trail, but the information I'm after is apparently on the internet. Could you hit a few sites for me? Help me get my hands on it?
Yes.
Gracias. I passed her the addresses and gave her a brief rundown of what I was looking for. I'm going to be out and about. I'll call you in an hour or two.
She sighed and nodded. Did you find the vampires?
Not yet, but I got some backup.
Who?
She asked. Guy named Kincaid. He's tough.
A wizard?
No. One of those Soldier of Fortune types. Pretty good vampire slayer.
Murphy arched a brow. Is he clean?
As far as I know, I said. I should hear from our wheelman tonight. With luck, I'll find the lair, and we'll hit them.
Hey, if it just so happens that we have to go after them on
Saturday, I finished for her. I know. I left and told the pup my theory about familial dementia on the way down the stairs. It's just a theory, mind you, but it's got the support of a ton of empirical evidence. I felt a quiet pang of sadness as I spoke. Family troubles were something I hadn't ever had, wouldn't ever have. Murphy's problems with family might have been complicated and unpleasant, but at least they existed. Every time I thought I had gotten through my orphan baggage, something like this came up. Maybe I didn't want to admit how much it still hurt. Not even to myself. I scratched the pup's notched ear as I walked out to the beetle. My theory is just theoretical, I told him. Because how the hell should I know?
Chapter 12. I swung past my apartment to grab lunch, a shower, and some clothes without so much blood on them. A beat-up old rabbit had lost a game of bumper tag with a Suburban, and traffic was backed up for a mile. As a result, I got back to the set a few minutes late. A vaguely familiar girl with a clipboard met me at the door. She wasn't old enough to drink, but made up for a lack of maturity with what I could only describe as a gratuitous amount of perkiness. She was pretty, more awkwardly skinny than sleek, and had skin the color of cream. Her dark hair was done up in Princess Leia cinnamon rolls, and she wore jeans, a peasant-style blouse, and clunky-looking sandals. "Hi," she said. "Hi yourself." She checked her clipboard. "You must be Harry, then. You're the only one left, and you're late." "I was on time this morning." "That makes you half as good as a broken watch. You should be proud." She smiled again to let me know she was teasing. "Didn't I see you talking to Justine at Arturo's party?" "Yeah, I was there. Had to leave before I turned into a pumpkin." She laughed and stuck out her hand. "I'm Inari. I'm an associate production assistant." I shook her hand. She wore some light, sweet scent that I liked, something that reminded me of buzzing locusts and lazy summer nights. "Nice to meet you. Unless you're stealing my job, you're not a scab, are you?" Inari grinned, and it transformed her face from moderately attractive to lovely. She had great dimples. "No, as an associate gopher, I'm down the ladder from you. I think your job is safe." She checked a plastic wristwatch. "Oh, God, we need to get moving. Arturo asked me to take you to his office as soon as you got here. This way." "What's he want?" "Beats me," Inari said. She started a brisk walk, and I had to lengthen my steps to keep up with her as she led me deeper into the building. She flipped to a second page and took a pen from behind one hair bun. "Oh, what would you like on your vegetarian pizza?" "Dead pigs and cows," I said. She glanced up at me and wrinkled her nose. "They're vegetarians," I said defensively. She looked skeptical. "With all the hormones and things they put in meats, you know that they're having a number of very bad effects on you, right? Do you know the kind of long-term damage fatty meats can do to your intestinal tract?" "I choose to exercise my status as an apex predator, and I laugh in the face of cholesterol." "With an attitude like that, you're going to wind up with bulletproof arteries." "Bring it." Inari shook her head, her expression pleasant and unyielding. "Everyone decided they wanted to stick with veggies when I order. If someone has meat, the grease will get all over the rest of the pizza, so they settled on veggies." "Then I guess I will, too." "But what do you want on yours? I mean, I'm supposed to make everyone happy here." "Kill me some animals, then," I said. "It's a protein thing." "Oh, you should have said," Inari replied, smiling at me. We stopped in front of a door, and she scribbled on her clipboard. "Some extra cheese, maybe some beans and corn. Or, wait, tofu. Protein. I'll fix you up." Bean curd pizza. Good grief. I should raise my rates. "You do that." The puppy stirred in my pocket, and I stopped. "Here, there's something you could help me with." She tilted her head at me. "Oh?" I reached into my pocket and drew the pup out. He was sleeping, every inch of him completely limp. "Could you keep my friend company while I talk to Arturo?" The girl melted with adoration, the way only girls can, and took the pup, cradling him in the crook of her arm and crooning to him. "Oh, he's so sweet. What's his name?" "No name," I said. "Just watching him for a day or three. He might be hungry or thirsty when he wakes up." "I love dogs," she replied. "I'll take good care of him." "Appreciate it." She started to walk away. "Oh, Harry, I almost forgot. What do you want to drink? Is Coke okay?" I eyed her suspiciously.
It isn't non-caffeinated, is it? She arched a brow. I'm health conscious, not insane. Dear child, I said. She gave me another sunny smile and jounced off down the hall, holding the pup as if he were made of glass. I went into the office. Arturo Genosa was inside, sitting on the corner of a desk. His silver hair looked rumpled, and a half-smoked cigar smoldered in a thick ashtray beside him. He summoned up a tired smile for me as I came in. Hey, howdy. He came over and gave me one of those manly Mediterranean hugs, the kind that leave bruises.
God bless you, Mr. Dresden. Without you there, I think we would have lost them both. Thank you.
He kissed me on either cheek. I'm not a kissy-huggy type, really, but I figured it was another manly European affection thing. Either that or he'd just marked me for death. I stepped back and said, The girl gonna be all right? Arturo nodded.
Going to live? All right? That I don't know.
He waved a hand at his neck.
The scars, they will be very bad.
Tough on an actress. He nodded.
In the phone book, your ad says you give advice.
Technically, I sell it, I said. But that's really more for...
I need to know, he said. Need to know whether I should stop the project.
I arched an eyebrow. You think that's why these people have been attacked? He picked up his cigar, fiddling around with it.
I don't know what to think. But I was nowhere nearby. This could not have been an attack on me.
I agree, I said. And it was the evil eye, I'm sure of it.
Mr. Dresden, if a man threatens me, then it is nothing to face it. But this person, whoever he is hurting the people near me. I no longer choose only for myself.
Why would someone want to stop your film, Mr. Genosa? I asked. I mean, pardon me if this insults you, but it's a skin flick. There's lots of them.
I don't know. Maybe it is the business end, he said. Small entrepreneur, maybe could be a threat to more entrenched businessmen. So they lean, apply pressure. Quietly, you understand.
If I didn't know better, I'd swear you just told me that you were being persecuted by a covert pornography syndicate. Genosa put the cigar in his mouth, rolling it around. He drummed his fingers on the desk and lowered his voice.
You joke, but in the past few years, someone has been buying the studios a little at a time.
Who?
He shook his head. It's hard to say. I have investigated, but I am not a detective. Is there any way you could...
I'm already on it. I'll tell you if I turn up anything.
Thank you, he said. But what should I do today? I can't allow any of these people to be harmed.
You're racing the clock, right? If you don't finish the film, your business is kaput.
Yes.
How long do you have?
Today and tomorrow, he said.
Then you should ask yourself how willing you are to let ambition get someone killed. Then weigh it against how willing you are to let someone scare you out of living your life. I frowned. Or maybe lives, plural. You're right when you say you aren't choosing only for yourself.
How can I make that choice? He asked.
I shrugged. Look, Arturo, you need to decide if you are protecting these people or leading them. There's a difference. He rolled the cigar back and forth between his fingers and then nodded slowly.
They are adults. I am not their father. But I cannot ask them to risk themselves if they do not wish to. I will tell them they are free to leave, should they choose, with no ill will.
But you will stay? He nodded firmly. Leader, then, I said. Next thing you know, Arturo, I'll be buying you a big round table. It took him a second, but he laughed.
I see. Arthur and Merlin.
Yeah, I said. He regarded me thoughtfully.
Your advice is good. For a young man, you have good judgment.
You haven't seen my car. Arturo laughed. He offered me a cigar, but I turned him down with a smile. No, thank you.
You look troubled.
Yeah, something about your situation doesn't sit right with me. This whole thing is hinky. Genosa blinked.
It is what?
Hinky, I said. It's sort of a Chicago word. I mean that there's something not right about what's going on.
Yes, he agreed. People are getting hurt.
That's not it, I said. The attacks have been brutal. That means that the intentions of whoever is behind them are equally brutal. You can't sling around magic that you don't really believe in. That isn't something a simple business competitor would come up with, even assuming some hardball corporate types decided to start trying a supernatural angle instead of hiring $50 bruisers to lean on you.
You think it is personal? He asked.
I don't think anything yet, I said. I need to do more digging. He nodded, expression sober.
If you stay here, you can keep protecting my people?
I think so. He pressed his lips together, expression resolved.
Then I will tell the...
The door flew open, and a living goddess of a woman stormed into the office. She was maybe 5'4" and had brilliant, lush, blonde, highlighted red hair that fell to the small of her back. She wore only high-heeled pumps and a matching dark green two-piece set of expensive-looking designer lingerie, translucent enough to defeat the purpose of wearing clothing at all. It ably displayed all kinds of pleasant proportions of tanned, athletic female.
Arturo, you Euro-trash pig, she snarled. What do you think you were doing, bringing that woman here?
Genosa flinched at the tone and did not look at the woman.
Hello, Trish.
Do not call me that, Arturo. I've told you over and over.
Genosa sighed.
Harry, this is my newest ex-wife, Tricia Scrump.
And he let this gem slip out of his fingers? Shocking. The woman's eyes narrowed.
Trixie, vixen. It's been legally changed.
Okay, Arturo said mildly. Now, what are you talking about?
You know full well what I'm talking about, she spat the words. If you think you're going to split this feature between two stars, you are sadly mistaken.
That isn't going to happen at all, he said. But with Giselle hurt, I had to find someone else, and on such short notice.
Don't patronize me, Trisha ground her teeth. Lara is retired. Re-ti-erd. This film is mine. I am not going to let you use my drawing power to fuel a comeback appearance for that bitch.
I thought about pots and kettles.
It won't be an issue, Genosa said. She has agreed to a mask and a pseudonym. You are the star, Tricia. That has not changed.
Trixie Vixen folded her arms, geometrically increasing her cleavage.
Fine, then, she snapped. As long as we understand each other.
We do, Arturo said.
She threw her hair back over her shoulder, a gesture filled with arrogance, and glared at me.
And who is this?
Harry, I provided, production assistant.
Well then, Larry, where the hell is my latte? I sent you for it an hour ago.
Evidently, reality did not often intrude on Tricia Scrump's life. It was probably shacked up with courtesy somewhere. I prepared to return verbal fire, but a panicked look from Arturo stopped the first reply that sprang to mind. Sorry, I'll take care of it.
See that you do, she said.
She spun on one high heel, displaying her G-string and an ass that probably deserved its own billing in the credits, and stalked out. At least, she started to. She abruptly stopped, frozen, her body tightening with tension. A woman that made Trixie Vixen look like the ugly stepsister appeared in the door and blocked the starlet's exit. I had to force myself not to stare. Tricia, Trixie, Scrump, nay Genosa, nay Vixen's beauty was up to code. You could run a checklist from it. Lovely mouth, deep eyes, full breast, slender waist, flared hips, long and shapely legs, check, check, check. She looked like she'd been ordered from a catalog and assembled from a kit. She was a vision of a woman, but a prefabricated one, painted by numbers. The newcomer was the real thing. She was grace, beauty, art. As such, she was not so easily quantified. She would have been tall, even without the heeled faux Victorian boots of Italian leather. Her hair was so dark that its highlights were nearly blue,
a torrent of glossy curls held partially in check with a pair of milky ivory combs. She had eyes of dark gray with hints of violet twilight at their centers. Her clothes were all effortless style, natural fabrics, black skirt, and jacket embroidered with abstract dark crimson roses with a white blouse. Thinking back later, I couldn't clearly remember her facial features or her body, beyond a notion that they were superb. Her looks were almost extraneous. They weren't any more important to her appeal than a glass was to wine. It was at its best when invisible and showing the spirit contained within. Beyond mere physical presence, I could sense the nature of the woman. Strength of will, intelligence, blended with a sardonic wit and edged with a lazy, sensuous hunger. Or maybe the hunger was mine. In the space of 5 seconds, my attention to detail fractured, and I wanted her. I wanted her in the most primal sense, in every way I could conceive. Whatever gentle and chivalrous tendencies my soul harbored suddenly evaporated. Images swarmed over me, images of unleashing the fires burning in me upon willing flesh. Conscience withered a heartbeat later. Something hungry, confident, and unrepentant took its place. I realized, on some distant level, that something was wrong, but there was no tangible, tactile sense of truth to the thought. Instincts ruled me, and only the most feral, vicious drives remained. I liked it. A lot. While my inner Neanderthal was pounding his chest, Trixie Vixen took a step back from the dark-haired woman. I couldn't see her face, but her voice crackled with too much anger. She was afraid.
"Hello, Lara?"
"Trish," the woman said, with faint, contemptuous emphasis on the name. Her voice smoldered, so low and delicious that my toes started to curl up.
"You look lovely." "I'm surprised to see you here," Trisha said. "There aren't any whips or chains on the set."
Lara shrugged, perfectly relaxed. "I've always felt that the best whips and chains are in the mind. With a little creativity, the physical ones are hardly necessary." Lara stared down at Trisha for a moment and then asked, "Have you given any more thought to my offer?"
"I don't do bondage films," Trisha said. A sneer colored the words. "They're for wrinkled old has-beens."
She started forward with a determined stride. Lara didn't move. Trisha stopped a bare inch from her, and they met gazes again. The red-headed film star started trembling.
"Perhaps you're right," Lara said.
She smiled and stepped clear of the doorway.
"Keep in touch, Trish."
Trixie Vixen fled. At least as much as someone wobbling away on 6-inch heels can flee. The dark-haired woman watched her with a smug smile on her mouth and then said,
"Exit scene. It must be difficult to be the center of the universe. Good afternoon, Arturo."
"Lara," Arturo said. His tone was that of an uncle chiding his favorite niece.
He came around his desk and walked over to the woman, offering both hands.
"You shouldn't tease her like that."
"Arturo," she said warmly. She took his hands and they did more social cheek kissing. I shook my head while they did, and managed to shove my libido out of the driver's seat of my brain. Captain of my own soul. Even if my pants were considering mutiny. I began focusing my thoughts, building up a barrier to shield them.
"You are an angel," Arturo said to her.
His voice was steady and kind, and not at all that of a man having most of his blood channeled south of his belly button. How the hell could he not have reacted to her presence?
"An angel to come here so quickly to help me."
She waved a hand in a lazy motion. Her fingernails weren't terribly long and didn't have any polish.
"I'm always glad to help a friend, Arturo. Are you all right?" she asked. "Joan said you'd forgotten to refill your prescription."
He sighed.
"I'm fine. Lowering my blood pressure would not have helped Giselle."
Lara nodded.
It's horrible, what happened. I'm so sorry.
Thank you, he said. I am not sure I am comfortable to have Inari here. She's a child.
That's arguable, Lara said. After all, she's old enough to perform now, if she wishes.
Arturo looked startled and a little sick.
Lara!
She laughed. I'm not saying she should, dear fool, only that my baby sister makes her own choices now.
They grow, Arturo said. His voice was a little sad.
They do, Lara's eyes moved over to me. And who is this? Tall, dark, and silent. I like him already.
Harry, Arturo replied. He beckoned me over. Lara Romani, meet Harry, our new production assistant. He just started today, so be kind to him.
That shouldn't be too hard, she said, and slipped her arm through Genosa's. Joan wanted me to tell you that your prescription came in, and that she needs your help on the set.
Arturo nodded with a strained but genuine smile.
And you are to escort me down to take my medicine, huh?
Via my feminine wiles, Lara confirmed.
Harry, Arturo said.
I need to make a quick call, I answered. I'll be right behind you.
The two of them left. Lara threw another look at me over her shoulder, her expression speculative. And hot. I mean, wow. If she'd crooked her finger, I think I would have been in danger of floating off the floor and drifting along behind her on a cloud of her perfume. Me and Pepe Le Pew.
It took me maybe half a minute after they walked away before I was able to reboot my brain. After that, I ran a quick review of what had just happened through the old gray matter.
Pretty, pale, supernaturally sexy, and just a little scary. I could do the math, and I was willing to bet that Romani wasn't Lara's last name. She looked a hell of a lot more like a wraith. Son of a bitch. The White Court was here. A succubus on the set. Strike that. The health-conscious kid sister made it, too. Succubuses. Succubuses? Succubi? Stupid Latin correspondence course. Or maybe she wasn't one, because I hadn't felt a thing like the attraction Lara Romani exuded when I was near little Inari. It really hit me, then, that I'd wandered into a mess that might get me killed, regardless of how silly and embarrassing it sounded. Now, I had to contend not only with pornography syndicate conspiracies, but also a succubus of the White Court, or maybe more than one, which for grammatical reasons I hoped was not the case. So, in addition to a feisty new Black Court partner in the war dance between the Council and the Vampire Courts, I also got angry lust bunny movie stars, deadly curses, and a thoroughly embarrassing job as my investigative cover. Oh, and bean curd pizza, which is just wrong. What a mess. I made a mental note. The next time I saw Thomas, I was going to punch him right in the nose.
Chapter 13. After two or three tries, I got Genosa's phone to dial out to Murphy.
It's me, Murph. You get that information off the internet?
Yeah, and then I talked to some people I know out there. I dug up some goodies for you.
Peachy. Like what?
Nothing that will stand up in a court, but it might help you figure out what's going on.
Wow, Murph. It's as if you were a detective.
Bite me, Dresden. Here's the deal on Genosa. He's a dual citizen of the States and Greece. He's the last son of a big money family that fell on hard times. Rumor has it he left Greece to avoid his parents' debts.
Uh-huh, I said. I continued searching through Genosa's desk and found a big old leather-bound photo album.
I'm listening. He wound up making and directing sex films, did well investing the money, and he's worth a little more than $4 million, personally.
Sex sells, I frowned, flipping through the photo album. It was neatly packed with excerpts from newspapers, transcripts, and photos of Genosa on the set of a number of national talk shows. There was another of him standing beside Hugh Hefner and surrounded by a number of lovely young women. That's a lot of money. Is that all? No, Murphy said. He's paying alimony to three ex-wives out of some kind of fund set up to provide it. He's got almost all of what's left tied up in starting his own studio. I grunted. Genosa's under some serious pressure, then. How so? He's only got about 36 hours to finish his movie, I said. He's got one project done, but if he doesn't get a pair of profitable films, he'll lose the studio. You figure someone's trying to run him out of business? Occam thinks so. I turned another page and blinked at the article there. Damn. What? He's a revolutionary. He's what? Murphy asked. I repeated myself redundantly again. Apparently Arturo Genosa is considered a revolutionary in his field. I could almost hear Murphy lift a skeptical eyebrow. A revolutionary boink czar? So it would seem. She snorted. How exactly do you get to become a porn revolutionary? Practice, 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 I guessed. Wise ass? I kept flipping pages, skimming the album. He's been interviewed in about 30 magazines. Yeah, Murphy said. Probably with illustrious names like Jugs a Poppin' and Barely Legal Lolita Schoolgirls. I thumbed through pages. And People, Time, Entertainment Weekly, and USA Today. He's also been on Larry King and Oprah. You're kidding, she said. Oprah? Why? Hang on, I'm reading. It looks like he's got this crazy notion that everyone should be able to enjoy themselves in bed without going insane trying to meet an impossible standard. He thinks that sex is natural. Sex is natural, Murphy said. Sex is good. Not everybody does it, but everybody should. I'm the wise ass. You're the cop. Respect my boundaries. I kept reading. Genosa also casts people of a lot of different ages instead of using only 20-year-old dancers. According to a transcript of Larry King, he avoids gynecological close-ups and picks people based on the genuine sensuality of their performance rather than purely on appearance. And he doesn't believe in using surgically altered, My face heated up. Murphy was probably my best friend, but she was still a girl, and a gentleman just doesn't say some words in front of a lady. I held the phone with my shoulder and made a cupping motion in front of my chest with both hands. You know. Boobs? Murphy said brightly. Jugs? Hooters? Yayas? I guess. She continued as if I hadn't said anything. Melons? Torpedoes? Tits? Gazongas? Knockers? Tatas? Hell's bells, Murph! She laughed at me. You're cute when you're embarrassed. I thought breast implants were required industry equipment, like hard hats and steel-toed boots for construction workers. Not according to Genosa, I said. He's quoted here saying that natural beauty and genuine desire make for better sex than all the silicone in California. I'm not sure whether I should be impressed or a little nauseous, Murphy said. Six of one and half dozen of another, I said. Bottom line is that he's not your average pornographic artist. I'm not sure that's saying much, Harry. If you'd said that before I met him, I'd probably have agreed. But I'm not so sure now. I don't get any nasty vibe off him. He seems like a decent guy. Taking some measure of responsibility. Challenging the status quo, even if it hurts his profits. I'm pretty sure there's no Nobel Prize for pornography. My point is that he's applying some measure of integrity to it, and people are responding well to him. Except for the ones trying to kill him, Murphy said. Harry, this is cynical, but people who choose a life like that draw problems down onto themselves sooner or later. You're right. That is cynical. You can't help everyone. You'll go insane if you try. Look, the guy is in trouble, and he's a fellow human being. I don't have to love his lifestyle to want to keep bad things from happening to him. Yeah, Murphy sighed. I guess I know this tune. Do you think I could convince you to... The skin on the back of my neck went cold and clammy, tingling. I turned to the office doorway in time to see the lights in the hall flick out. My heart pounded in sudden apprehension. A shadowy figure appeared in the office door. I picked up the first thing my hand found. Genosa's heavy glass ashtray and flung it hard at the figure. The ashtray rebounded off the inner edge of the door and struck whoever it was. I heard a voiceless gasp of air. At the same time, something hissed past my ear. A sharp thumping sound came from the wall behind me. I shouted at the top of my lungs and ran forward, but my foot tangled in the phone cord. It didn't tug me into a pratfall, but I stumbled, and it gave the shadowy figure time to run. By the time I'd recovered my balance and gotten to the hallway, I couldn't see or hear anyone. The hall itself was dark, and I couldn't remember the locations of either light switches or doors, which made a headlong pursuit less than advisable. It occurred to me that I made a wonderful target, leaning out of the door of the dimly lit office, and I slipped back inside, shutting and locking the door behind me as I went. I looked at whatever had thumped into the wall behind me and found, of all the stupid things, a small dart fixed with exotic-looking yellow feathers, fringed with a tinge of pink. I tugged the dart out of the wall. It was tipped with what appeared to be bone instead of metal, and the bone was stained with something dark red or dark brown. I had the feeling it wasn't turtle wax. A poisoned blowgun dart. I'd been ambushed before, but that was pretty exotic, even for me. Almost silly, really. Who the hell got killed with poison blowgun darts these days? A buzz of noise came from the dropped receiver of the phone. I picked up an empty plastic cigar tube from next to Genosa's humidor and slipped the dart into it, then capped it before I picked up the phone.
Harry? Murphy was demanding. Harry, are you all right?
Fine, I said. And it looks like I'm on the right track.
What happened?
I held up the cigar tube and peered at the dart. The poisoned tip gleamed with its semi-gelatinous stain. It was pretty clumsy, but I think someone just tried to kill me.